Join me on this episode of Sell TV. You have questions about cannabis, CBD oil? Yeah, well, this scientist is going to talk about why it may be the biohack of this century because of stress and how it affects your endocannabinoid system and how that can be an answer to your stress. And believe it or not, even an answer to help you burn fat as energy, change your mitochondrial health. And by the way, are you defining yourself with a SNP like the MTHFR gene? You better watch this episode. He brings some science to that. It may not be what you think. I'll just say that. And also, we're going to shed light on mitochondrial health. This is why people can't burn fat for energy. They can't lose weight, don't have energy, period, right? Brain fog, digestive issues, mitochondrial issues. He has some really cool biohacks. We talk about some really cool stuff around that. Join me on this episode of Sell TV.
Welcome to Cellular Healing TV. Today, we're going to be discussing epigenetics and mitochondrial function with nutrigenomic consultant Steve Ottersberg. Just a bit about Steve. This is a great episode. He's going to be such a great guest. With graduate training in drug design, Steve was immersed in a world of genetic code, enzyme kinetics, and toxicology. From biochemical pathways, cellular function to physiology, the mitochondria is the key to health. Cancer cells that have depleted the mitochondria can lead to cancer progression. And Steve is here to discuss all of this with Dr. Pompa, and it's going to be just a mind-blowing episode. So I'm going to turn it over to you. Welcome, both of you.
Thanks, Ash. Yeah, you know, Steve, it's funny because you said you could just introduce me as the chief egghead, and I thought that was pretty funny. Yeah. I mean, when I look at your pedigree here, I mean, my gosh. I mean, obviously taught biochemistry and studying of epigenetics, which is one of my favorite topics, and the mitochondria, one of my huge topics. I mean, when we look at people today, lack of energy, can't lose weight, autism, I can go down and keep going down, cancer, of a lot of different diseases, Parkinson's, all which are being affected by this massive insult that we're having today. Because of today's stressors, honestly, of the mitochondria, you bring a whole new light to that. And I have to tell you, you know how I found out about you? I was interviewing your wife, Naysha, and Dr. Naysha, she's a naturopathic doctor. Matter of fact, Ashley, you can add her interview to this because I think we discussed you a little bit, Steve. Anyways, she was basically telling me what you know her husband was doing in the other room. I'm like, what's he doing? He's yeah. He talks about epigenetics. I'm like, I have to interview him. This is one of my favorite topics. So here we are with an interview that I think you are going to bring your egghead views to a topic that so many people need to hear more about, honestly, Steve. So thank you for being on Sell TV. You're gonna
of course, my pleasure.
Yeah,
I'm absolutely honored.
Yeah, I have to ask you this. I mean, you know, I don't know how you ended up with all the areas of study you did. So you might want to just tell a little bit about your story because, you know, and then you married a naturopathic doctor. I mean, you were developing drugs from Merck. Am I right about that? I mean, how did you enter our world, dude? Is it just marrying into it? What happened?
Well, I think, you know, how far do we need to go back? I mean, number one, I'm youngest of 10 kids, and almost all of my family members are scientists of one flavor or another. We met an undergrad in anatomy and physiology lab back when I was in a pre-med track. And I ended up deciding, you know, going through undergrad, as most people do, that medicine was not for me. Hmm. You know, and part of it was I fell in love with organic chemistry. And that's how I ended up doing drug design.
It was a financial mistake, but anyway,
well, probably. Well, but I also have this ultra acute sense of smell. So I don't know if clinical medicine is absolutely the right place for my acute sense of smell.
That's funny. I have a very acute sense of smell too. It came out of my chemical sensitivity for when I was sick. But I still go, who has their shoes off? What's going on?
Yeah. Well, like when I, so In grad school, I did drug design because I just have a really innate talent in organic chemistry. It's just something that makes sense to me. The three-dimensional aspect of organic chemistry and a lot of, you know, the chemical aspect.
Too, actually, it was the geometry aspect that I just got. Whereas regular chemistry, the formulas, blah, blah, blah. Organic, I got that.
Yeah, same here. I was an average student in general chemistry. And when I got to organic chemistry, it's like my brain for the first time in my life realized, oh my God, this is where you're supposed to be.
So we have one thing in common, maybe the last thing. Well, no, our love for epigenetics. Okay, good.
Yeah, there's plenty. And our love for Dave Asprey too. I mean, that was where I first heard you.
That's great.
So, you know, Nash and I met in undergrad and we ended up going to grad school together. And I chose the graduate program that I did because Nash and I were struggling between, I wanted to go to the Linus Pauling Institute in Oregon when she was looking at naturopathic school in Oregon. And somehow we ended up in Tempe, Arizona between Washington and Oregon.
Nice place.
Don't ask me about that. Totally opposite climate of what we were looking at. But we both ended up going to grad school together. And in grad school, I ended up doing cancer drug design, which ended up landing me in the middle of Merck Pharmaceutical because Merck had been working on the same class of drugs that I was working on in grad school, and they were getting ready to launch this class of drugs as I left grad school. Mm-hmm. So that took me into the pharmaceutical world for 4 years, which was weird because I was the only pharmaceutical rep with an honorary naturopathic degree. And I had gotten an honorary naturopathic degree because for about 6 years, for grad school and a couple years after grad school, I had been teaching biochemistry board reviews to NASH's classmates. And because of that, they gave me an honorary ND, but they also taught me so much because naturopathic medical students have the best biochemistry questions ever across the board. And so they helped reaffirm my love affair with the mitochondria. And it's simply because, you know, to me, the mitochondria, like the liver, you know, I refer to the liver and the mitochondria as the ghosts of each other because the mitochondria is the grand central station of all chemical reactions in the human body. Uh-huh. And the liver is grand central station to all physiological reactions in the human body.
Let me explain that a little bit better. I mean, I get some people are watching this going, what is the mitochondria? I swear. But it's where you make energy, it's the powerhouse. If we go back simple biology, the liver is where you process all your toxins. So kind of draw that inclusion in simple terms again.
So when you look at, do you remember in medical school, do you remember the giant biochemical pathway that took up an entire wall?
Oh, yeah.
The central pathway to all other biochemical pathways is the mitochondria. Mm. The mitochondria it's not just where energy is produced. Right. I keep referring to it as grand central station because it's where all chemicals meet in terms of all biochemical pathways.
So, which explains why we see so much mitochondrial dysfunction today at the heart of most conditions, because of what you just said right there. Very few people are actually talking about that. I mean, all the way back to Otto Warburg, you know, where he said, it's a mitochondrial issue. This thing's malfunctioning. It's doing this ancient glycolysis and it's causing this respiration issue and bad cells.
For Otto Warburg, that was his natural conclusion because he is a cell biologist. Mm-hmm. And for the cell, the mitochondria, and when I say mitochondria, that's plural because, you know, we look at our textbook drawing of a cell and we have one mitochondria per cell. But that's not how it is. They're, you know, cellular function is defined by the number of mitochondria that cell can possess. You know, and I say that kind of arrogantly. So I might irritate the DNA biologist, but DNA is important. The nucleus is important, but remember that the mitochondria has its own DNA.
I was just going to say that mitochondria has its own DNA. And what you mean by that is meaning that heart, your eyes, the cells have far more mitochondria because they require so much more energy, right?
Yep. And what histological cell type has the most mitochondria?
I thought the eye, no, am I wrong? I guess I'm wrong.
Well, the eye is pretty dense, but look at the color of the liver.
Mm, the liver is warm.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of that's from the cytochromes, from detoxification. But here's the thing about the liver that most people don't think about. And, you know, everybody thinks, oh, the liver is there for detoxification. Well, the liver is also there as a organ of management of all of our cellular energy. Did you know that the liver has a greater capacity of controlling blood sugar than the pancreas does?
I knew that.
Of course you did.
But yeah. most people don't, right? But, you know, the liver has so much to do. Look, toxic people, they can't control glucose. And right. The liver is obviously, the cell itself is a big part of that, but the liver is a massive part of that as well. I mean, just swear to me, glucose, for goodness sake.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the mitochondria, to me, I started coming up with this conclusion of the importance of the mitochondria teaching naturopathic medical students about how the pathways tie together. Because, you know, I was teaching them to prepare for their MPLEX board review. So, you know, they have to take their basic science boards at the end of their second year before they can get into clinic. And their board review questions were always very physiologically relevant. And so I couldn't talk about glycolysis without talking about how glycolysis is related to glucogenic amino acids and ketogenic amino acids and fat metabolism. And that relationship between all of those pathways is the mitochondria.
Right. So how you use fat, how you utilize sugar, how you burn fat for energy or not.
Yeah.
I mean, all these aspects, a lot, you know, I mean, how much energy you have at the throughout your day. I mean, basically all of that is governed by what you're talking about here. So, you know, okay. So we have a lot of conditions that are being affected by the mitochondria, why people can't lose weight, brain fog. I mean, I'm just bringing it to like the average person watching this show going, that's me. We're telling you, yeah, you have a mitochondrial issue to one degree or another. Obviously the extremes are cancer and some other extremes, but I mean, it starts with the brain fog, the lack of energy. You can't lose weight, right? This is where mitochondrial issues start.
Yep.
Okay. So what do you say the biggest effect is on these areas? What's affecting the mitochondria to give those symptoms that most people watching this have?
Here is where I start losing friends. Sugar.
Oh yeah, we just lost half of our viewers. Okay, come on back. we have solutions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, here's the thing is when I first started studying physiology, I was an Olympic hopeful triathlete. And I was interested in learning physiology because I wanted to make it to the 92 Olympics. And as a triathlete, I trained tirelessly. I mean, I would go to swim practice 5 days a week. I would do 50 to 70 mile rides 3 or 4 times a week. So my very existence was dependent on optimizing my physiology so that my mitochondria would give me more endurance. And I learned early on that sugar is not necessarily the best fuel for endurance athletes. And I started to struggle with that in undergrad because I had a very, very, very deep-seated sugar addiction.
But by the way, many endurance athletes do, because they buy into carbohydrates or the fuel, carb, 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 and they're high carbers, and they all end up with metabolic problems later. Another story, but you're right about that.
Yeah, correct. And so I, you know, over time I learned that fat was a better fuel as an endurance athlete than sugar was because it gave me sustained energy. I mean, you know the term bonk. You know, endurance athletes will talk about bonking.
You waste your stored sugar out, all your glycogen, and you're done because your inability to burn fat for energy.
Yeah. And so when somebody says that they're bonking, they say that they go hypoglycemic. And what that is it's that transition between burning carbohydrate and burning fat. It is always a little bit of a chunky situation when you can't stop and rest.
Yeah.
And so for the endurance athlete, when they start out burning sugar, but then they try to transition into burning fat mid-race, often they're going to struggle through that transition period between the burning of sugar and the burning of fat.
You know, and one of the things that people have to understand is the key to being fat adapted athletes, and I've done shows, I interviewed Zach Bitters, all these guys breaking these barriers, and you know, they're all fat adapted. But the difference is, it's not that they don't use sugar. When you go high intensity, you're burning sugar.
Yep.
But the problem is most of the race, you're not. And then your body can hold on to that sugar when it needs to pass someone or accelerate,
yep,
you know, or do a high burn. But most of the time you're burning your stored fat, your own body's fat. And therefore you're using your sugar when you actually need it. Otherwise the other athlete's not using their fat, and they're just using up their stored sugar. So they have to do this the whole time they're running.
Exactly. But I think that the key is what you said, is fat adapted. You know, it's that metabolic flexibility that is lacking. And let's go back to sugar. I mean, the fact is that today, I mean, what does the average American consume in terms of pounds of sugar per year? Last time I researched, it's like 185 pounds of sugar on average, I'm not in the average. I'm way below average. So there's somebody else out there that's eating.
And by the way, Steve, that doesn't account for the processed carbohydrates, right? That doesn't account for the white bread, the white rice, all the carbs for that matter, that really ends up turning into sugar. They're talking about just processed sugar there with that number.
Yep, exactly. Yeah. And so the physiological consequence of eating a 5 days supply of sugar for every meal of the day is an inability to be fat adapted, which is a result of poor mitochondrial function. I mean, when you look at the physiological consequence of eating that much sugar, in that concentration, sugar is I call it a mitochondrial poison.
Yeah.
Because the normal regulatory mechanism of those pathways shuts off the mitochondria when there is that much sugar present. So that's just,
I mean, Steve, people would argue, okay, the mitochondria is obviously set up to use sugar, aka glucose. So correct. What you're saying is it's the volume that becomes the poison in the destruction to the mitochondria itself.
Correct.
Okay. And correct. Without digging in, you know, without geeking out here, which I know you so want to do, it's like, why is that? I mean, why is too much sugar? What is it doing to the mitochondria that it's shutting it down?
So the natural consequence of having a high state of glucose is that when your blood glucose is high, your body thinks that it's in a well-fed state, which is normal. And your body should feel that on occasion. But when you look at our, like, 200-year history, think back 200 years ago, how often was the human body in the well-fed state that we experience today?
Yeah, periodically at best, right?
Right, harvest time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in the fall when the fruit was ripe, we would gorge ourselves
absolutely
on sugar. And we would have periods of low calorie intake, high fat intake, because the sugar's all gone, because the apples are all gone and our cider is gone, and all we have left is tallow to get us through the dead of winter.
And by the way, you just described my feast famine cycling, my diet variation principle.
Yeah.
Our DNA is set up to have times of feast and famine, and the feast, when they're done periodically, are actually healthy. They remind
absolutely
us of starving and all these good things happen. But you take the famine away, now you get a problem.
That's precisely the problem, is that we don't any longer have cycles of feast and famine. We just have cycles of feast. And that's why we are metabolically inflexible, is because our mitochondria are continuously downregulated from a high sugar diet. So our mitochondria don't get to flex their fat-burning muscles. And without practice, we downregulate the number of mitochondria that our cells have, and then we start to have issues like degenerative diseases, like cancer, Alzheimer's, ALS, all of the degenerative diseases that are growing today in our modern society could be prevented by simply instilling a fast with our famine. You know, we have to have feast with our famine. We can have feast, but we have to fast after we feast.
Absolutely. And you need both. Matter of fact, my new book coming out, Beyond Fasting, it's coming out at the end of this month. I talk all about my feast famine concept, right? And when I looked at the literature on diets, right, they compared diets of low fat diet continually, high fat. I mean, they did all the different diets. You know what worked the best? A diet that varied. Feast, famine always worked better for weight loss. Therefore, I'll conclude that because it forces the body to adapt in some genetic way, and you can explain it better than I, something really good is happening to the mitochondria when we do feast and famine together versus, you know, one diet all the time, so to speak.
Yep.
So, you know, bring some light to that. Adaptation obviously is the key here.
It is. And so this is the thing with genetics. Our genetics is relatively static. We're going to die with pretty much the same genetic blueprint that we're born with. You know, we have some events in life that will change our genes, but for the most part, you can think of your genetics as being static. But here's the thing about your genetics is you have the genes to encode for every possible epigenetic trigger that your body or your ancestors have been exposed to.
Okay, so for example, Steve, I just back up because you said something very big there. As humans, we have how many genes? 25,000, 26? Like
almost, yeah, I mean, it's huge.
Okay.
Gazillions, like 27 billion.
I'm talking about like as our actual genes that we get, right? You know what I'm saying? Okay, so epigenetically is where all of the big changes of who you are, Steve, right? In other words, who you are is an epigenetic issue versus more so than, kind of explain the difference, because there's a big difference of genes and what happens epigenetically expression.
So let's just look at, if we look at one gene for one enzyme in the mitochondria, let's just look at a single, let's not even name. Let's just say that it's gene X in the mitochondria, that gene contains the information to code for a protein that has something to do with mitochondrial function. But you can encode that, or your gene contains the information to encode that protein under five or six different conditions.
Mm.
So that protein can change based upon the epigenetic triggers that you are currently experiencing.
Okay.
So let's say that you are in medieval England and you're eating a diet that's high in protein, low in vegetables. You might produce one epigenetic expression of that gene. Then you place yourself in New York City 2017 and you're drinking Starbucks. Well, you're going to have a different epigenetic trigger, and that gene is going to produce a different protein than your old ancestor did.
Right. So this explains why you can have identical twins.
Yep.
And if they grow up in the same environment, I mean, they're like almost like you can't even tell them apart, right? I mean, it's like the way they speak, the way they do this. But you pull them aside, grow up in different environments, and now they're liking different things. Their tastes are different. This is different. Same hardware. Right.
Yep.
Maybe it's best to explain this to people as hard drives and you know, software, right?
Yeah.
You know, they have the same hard drive, but yet they plugged in different software because their environment was different, which changed their genes, and they come out to be so different.
Yeah. I think the hard drive analogy is great because, you know, you can imagine that if your DNA is your hard drive, that's not necessarily going to change, but it's going to hold the information for the applications that you run, correct? And
yep.
Let's just say that if you had an identical twin that grew up in a different environment, your identical twin is going to be running application 1.0A,
right?
And because of your environment, you're going to be running application 1.0B.
Okay. So, and then that, therefore, now we have two very different people expressing very different lives with the same hard drive. Okay. So that explains then that epigenetics rules. I mean, there's diseases that are pure genetic diseases, chromosomes misplaced.
Yeah, absolutely.
What percentage is that, Steve?
it's a very, the genes that are, the diseases that are absolutely genetically based is a very small percentage.
Very small.
Yes. Because most disease that we are experiencing in modern medicine today are lifestyle diseases.
Right.
You know, there are a small percentage of cancer patients that doesn't matter what they do, they're going to get cancer. The largest percentage of cancer patients today can completely redirect their prognosis with diet and lifestyle.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. Okay. So here's the point, folks, that Steve and I are getting at, that environment, stressors, physical, chemical, emotional, can turn on your set of genes and start expressing things for worse. Now, there is good news, because we're going to talk about things, how to turn them off, good one, turn the bad ones off and turn good ones on, because that too has been an area of your study, right? That we can actually change our expression. If a cancer gene, a thyroid, an autoimmune gene is triggered from a stressor, turned on, but we can actually change it. So you talk about a lot of these epigenetic changes happening in the mitochondria. So talk about that. You know, we talked about sugar. That can turn on genes in your mitochondria, and now you're stuck just being able to use sugar, and you go, I have to eat all day long instead of utilizing your fat, right? That's a gene that can be changed. Am I right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
I have a very specific example for that. The enzyme lactate dehydrogenase is very important in metabolic flexibility. And this is something that Naisha taught me. She's taught me some of the most amazing biochemistry tricks. And, you know, we kind of teach each other back and forth. So one of the things that she measures regularly in blood work that she does on her patients is lactate dehydrogenase, because in a cancer population, when epigenetically the patient is leaning towards a cancering state, meaning that their cancer cells are starting to direct their physiology, this is when lactate dehydrogenase enzyme in the plasma starts to creep up. And so when Naisha sees somebody with an elevated blood sugar, elevated hemoglobin A1C, and an elevated lactate dehydrogenase, it starts to ring the bells of metabolic inflexibility. And it's kind of an epigenetic trigger that the cancer cells are starting to influence the relationship between the liver, muscle, and adipose tissue.
And by the way, I have to do a shameless plug. She's speaking on Saturday at my event in Nashville. That's the day that it's open to the public. So folks, Ashley will put the link on how you can sign up for that and even get the, we're doing a live stream because we literally like sold out the event. But so Ashley can give you that. But yes, she's speaking. She's going to be talking about that very testing and how she looks at that, and brilliant.
And so this is, you know, we all have the gene for lactate dehydrogenase, but we don't always express it at levels that, you know, that are causing problems. And that's the thing. So here's the beautiful thing about what Naisha does. I mean, just by putting somebody on a low carbohydrate diet, in a short amount of time, we can start to see their lactate dehydrogenase epigenetically reverse back to a state in which is more healthy, that is a sign of metabolic flexibility.
Yeah, and to your point, clinically, what we would see is someone who, you know, needs to eat all the time, hypoglycemic. Yep. They're kind of skinny fat. They'll break their muscle down before they'll burn their own darn fat, right? They crave carbohydrates, fail on every diet. I mean, I can keep going down a list describing somebody who's stuck as a sugar burner with the inability to use its own fat as energy. Yep. And there's the word metabolically flexible, meaning if I eat sugar, I'm going to burn the sugar out. It's dangerous. Yep. It'll burn up. If I'm not eating, my body burns its fat. So I don't have cravings. You stay lean and you have lasting energy. I mean, that's the metabolic flexibility thing. Okay, here's the issue, that some people, even on a low carbohydrate diet, I'm speaking clinically now, they just don't make that transition. And we know that toxins play a big factor here. because the toxins affect. So let's talk about toxins effect on the mitochondria. And even you like to talk about it, even mitochondrial epigenetics, right? It can keep that gene turned on. So talk about that.
So let's pick on heavy metals, first of all. Because
one of my favorite subjects.
Yeah, I mean, this is, and you actually taught me something about how heavy metal toxicity can be carried generationally.
Yeah.
And this is, to me, that was, I mean, it makes sense, absolutely, but it was shocking to hear, like, oh yeah, if a mother is exposed to mercury in utero, the baby is going to have mercury exposure as well.
And part of the other problem, Steve, is that the baby also inherited genes turned on that mom had turned on.
Correct.
So yep. It's a lose-lose.
Yeah. So when we look at mercury toxicity, there's a number of different things that's happening with mercury toxicity. And the number one thing for me as a biochemist, when I look at mercury is a soft, here goes my general chemistry terminology, just gone. Mercury is a soft metal, and we refer to metals as Lewis acids. And Lewis acids catalyze the
reaction. I forgot about that word.
You remember Lewis acids and Lewis bases? Right? And I had a little, you know, brain glitch there, getting it into my terminology, because I haven't used this terminology in a while.
Yeah, I think I purposely forgot about Lewis acids. But
anyway. Yeah, most of us do. And so the whole issue with Lewis acids is that they catalyze oxidation reactions. And so this is one of the many issues with mercury, is that mercury as a Lewis acid is catalyzing oxidation of sulfur molecule or sulfur atoms that are bound to molecules. And when you look at energy metabolism and methylation in particular, there are a lot of sulfur-containing biomolecules that are targeted by mercury. Mm. And so there's a physiological effect because of this pro-oxidative effect of the heavy metal. But then because mercury is fat soluble, it tends to get into the nucleus. And remember that when we talk about genetics and epigenetics, in order for genes to be expressed, the histones have to open up, right? I mean, if you think about your DNA as being in a wallet, you know, if you're going to spend your money from your DNA, you've got to open the wallet. And that's the analogy I like to use with histones. Histones are your DNA wallet. Your DNA is wound up around histones when it's in its stored state. And in order to open those histones, the histones have to be methylated. And that's where methylation is the first step of an epigenetic trigger, is that the histones have to be methylated to be opened up to express the DNA. And it turns out that mercury directly influences your ability to methylate your histones and open up your histones to express your DNA.
Right. And then boom, it gets, you know, certain genes get turned on. And now here you are expressing something you don't want to express, you know, whether it's obesity, resistance, diabetes. I mean, you know, we keep going down the list. So
like every other disease state, what is being expressed during heavy metal toxicity is the stress response is what's being expressed. Yeah. And there's a time and place for that.
And by the way, that's why one of the things that leads with mercury is people can't sleep. Yeah. You know, they have bad energy, yet they can't sleep right. Even when they do sleep, they don't get into deep sleep. And most of them wake up in the middle of the night, can't sleep. They have anxiety. I mean, all of these symptoms, you know, part of what you're saying is why they occur. So, all right. So we have over-sugared, over-toxic, all affecting the mitochondria directly, creating oxidation. It interferes with the way it works, and also turning on the genes in the mitochondria. So now you're expressing what we just talked about things, you know. So are we doomed, man, or can we turn these genes off? What do we do?
We are absolutely not doomed. And here is the best part of human physiology. Human physiology is incredibly adaptable. But in order to get human physiology to adapt, we have to give it the right conditions. So number one, stress is the biggest limitation of physiological adaptability. The stress hormones absolutely inhibit metabolic flexibility. So the first thing that we have to do in order for us to be able to have an adaptable physiology is we have to be able to manage stress. If we're constantly releasing cortisol, we're not going to be able to be metabolically flexible. There is nothing that we can do to the cortisol state that's going, you know, we can do any diet we want. But if we're adding a good quality diet on top of cortisol, it's not going to ever fix the problem.
And Steve, what, I mean, some people think, okay, you know, managing emotional stress is very difficult for some people, which, you know, there's strategies and we've done a lot of shows on those strategies, but there is the upstream toxic effect, right? We find that people have hidden infections in their jaw, right? I mean, metal in their brain, that's a constant, you know, stressor, chemical stress. And that's where my cellular detox comes down to lower that stress bucket. But what are other ways we can lower the stress bucket to mitigate what you're saying?
Well, in terms of physical stress or emotional stress?
Any of it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, well,
because here's the point. The body doesn't know the difference.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, here's the thing is, regardless of, you know, whatever your spiritual beliefs are, you have to have some mental, emotional, and spiritual support in your life.
I agree.
That's absolutely essential. And I don't care what you call it. Yoga, meditation, prayer, religion, community, anything that brings you a sense of community, a sense of belonging, nurture that. It's absolutely essential. And then you have to eat good food with those people that are nurturing your spiritual and love and all of that. You have to provide your body with the fuel to detoxify. I mean, if you're heavy metal toxic and you don't eat vegetables, well, you're going to continue to be heavy metal toxic, right? And so taking out the garbage is mental and emotional. It is not putting garbage in your mouth, but it's also not putting garbage in your field of vision.
Yeah.
You know, how many people are filling their minds with garbage and then wonder why they're sick? I mean, if you are just continuously filling your mind with garbage, your mind is going to output garbage. So fill your mind with the things that give you peace and give the world peace.
Here's an interesting biohack that you're an expert in. You've lectured maybe around the world, many, many lectures that I saw on your bio. And this is a topic of many people's interest, cannabinoids. AKA yes. CBD, AKA hemp.
Yeah.
Now I've got everyone's attention. You found that it has a profound effect. Some of the benefits that people receive from cannabinoids, and by the way, that's the active ingredient. I'll let Steve explain it more in what's in CBD. But you found a profound effect on changing the epigenetics to good. It has a profound effect on the mitochondrial epigenetics and a downregulating of cortisol and our, you know, cannabinoid system, which we recently discovered, right? How that plays into our hormone system and helps with adaptation. So this is a good biohack. Talk about it. You've lectured a lot on this topic.
So here's the thing with the endocannabinoid system is, you know, when you think about neurotransmission, neurotransmitters convey specific messages. But in general, we can break neurotransmitters down into excitatory and inhibitory neurotransmitters.
So these are signals from our brain to our cells through nerves, right? Yep. And it can be excitatory, contract,
yep,
or inhibitory, relax, right? That's what you're saying.
Exactly, yeah. So let's look at dopamine, for example. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that's very important for problem solving. Your baseline level of dopamine is what gives you the ability to think. And, you know, your dopaminergic neurons are important for your day-to-day cognitive function. And so the balance of dopamine transmission is very important. Where the endocannabinoid system comes in is the endocannabinoid system acts as a safety mechanism within the dopamine system, within all neurotransmission. And so what it does is when you have a spike in dopamine response, your endocannabinoid system will take that spike and it will modify it so that it does not cause problems. Because, you know, you have a basal level of dopamine, and then, you know, you're walking down the beach, you see a girl in a bikini, and your dopamine levels spike, right? You know, people are addicted to dopamine. This is video games. Right. This is pornography, cocaine, all of these things. Yeah, your iPhone is dopamine.
Yeah, well, you're expecting, it's like gambling, yeah, right? You expect, yeah. Oh, an email, oh, dopamine spike.
Yeah, yeah. And there, so dopamine is important in the pleasure and, you know, reward response, but you can't have dopamine firing all the time. And so what the endocannabinoid system does is it takes these spikes in dopamine and it kind of applies the anti-lock brakes. It doesn't stop the dopamine response or any other response that it's acting upon. What it does is it modulates the response so that it does not overtax the neurons that are undergoing this dopamine spike. And so one of the important functions of the endocannabinoid system is fear response extinction. So have you ever had, you know, a kid in your practice that has bad dreams over and over and over again?
By the way, when I was sick, when I was mercury toxic, I called them adrenaline dreams, and I hated it.
Yeah, and if you have this fear response over and over and over, that's a sign of poor endocannabinoid function. Because your endocannabinoid system, one of its purposes is to help you to forget painful memories.
So how does CBD, which contains cannabinoids, it obviously affects this endocannabinoid system, and that's why it helps so many people. And it also can downregulate epigenetics. So what got you studying this, and talk about how it does that?
So one of the reasons that I have always been interested in cannabis and in cannabinoids in particular is because of cancer in my family. My oldest brother died of pancreatic cancer. I have a sister that is about 12, 13 years out of treatment for ovarian cancer, another sister with ovarian cancer. And so there's a lot of cancer in my family. So it was one of the things that we just always knew, oh, well, if you have nausea and vomiting, this is a really good way to help. And throughout the course of my education, I've been exposed to people like Dr. Ethan Russo. Ethan Russo is an incredible resource. He's a neurologist, and he's an incredible resource on endocannabinoid function and the cannabinoids that are produced by the plant cannabis sativa. And one of the things that Ethan Russo says about cannabis as a therapeutic agent is one of its benefits is it helps people that have terminal diagnosis, and it helps them with the perception of that diagnosis, which can often be more damaging than the diagnosis itself. Because if somebody tells you that you have a terminal cancer, how are you going to process that diagnosis in terms of your emotional state? More than likely, you're going to play that diagnosis over and over in your brain because it's such a traumatic thing that you need help to extinguish that fear response associated with that diagnosis. That makes sense?
Yeah, and we know that our thoughts can actually turn genes on and off, right? I mean,
absolutely.
So therefore, to your point, that focus on it can actually keep genes, certain genes turned on and even turn on others that will not work for you but against you. So the mindset plays a critical role. I don't care what condition you have. But people don't get that. I mean, but there's science behind it, right? I mean, our thoughts change our genes.
Yeah. I mean, absolutely. The science behind the endocannabinoid system is emerging because the political state of endocannabinoid science in the United States has been really challenging from a scientific perspective because of the the federal classification of CBD and THC being Schedule One, it's really difficult to get an institutional review board to approve any kind of scientific study associated with cannabis. But what I just spoke last week at a cannabis conference in San Diego, and the first two speakers of this conference were vets. And they were talking about the desperate need that vets have for the treatment of PTSD. You know, when you think about what happens to a young or maybe not so young soldier that's out in the battlefield, you know, that constant stress of being in the battlefield, whether you're in action or not. I mean, I can only imagine what must go through the young soldiers' minds when they're in a foreign land, you know, walking through the battlefield in the middle of the night. What kind of stress response is going through their brains? I mean, it has to be, you know, tax season multiplied by 3 trillion, and you don't sleep for months. And so to me, this is one of the reasons why I'm passionate about education about the endocannabinoid system and education about the legitimate medical role for cannabis, whether it's in the form of hemp or whatever it's in the form of medical marijuana. It's a really important clinical tool because there are people that don't have, I mean, epigenetically or genetically, they're not hardwired to be able to extinguish their fears the same as others. You know, there's a molecule that's part of the endocannabinoid system called anandamide. Anandamide is Sanskrit for bliss. And they called this molecule anandamide because when it was first isolated, it was discovered that it is what causes bliss in mice. And here's another crazy thing that nobody's really talking about with the endocannabinoid system is that it's built upon dietary fatty acids. Mm-hmm. And so your dietary fatty acid intake directly influences your endocannabinoid tone. So that high omega-6 diet that is so, you know, so bad in terms of outcome for so many disease states is not only bad from an inflammatory perspective, but it's also bad from a mental functional perspective. There's one of my heroes in the scientific community is a researcher by the name of Oliver Manzoni. He works in France, and he does endocannabinoid studies on mice. And he has shown in mice that mouse studies, when mice are fed an omega-3 deficient diet, they lose neuroplasticity that is a function of their endocannabinoid tone.
You know, and I think in today's diet, you have vegetable oils and everything, even in whole foods. You have canola, I mean, all of it. Brain fed everything, and that creates the imbalance. Could that be one of the reasons why that people seem to have such a positive effect with cannabis, right? Meaning that, come on, I mean, you know, how could we need cannabis? I mean, meaning that it wasn't like our ancestors were walking around smoking marijuana, all of them, right? I mean, and, you know, all of a sudden there's this greater need for it in the sense of when people take it, they feel better. Is it all the stressors combined and it's just tapering down that dopamine expression? What is it exactly?
Well, number one, my ancestors were walking around smoking cannabis all the time. I'm kidding. No, I mean, but that's part of, this is part of the issue. I mean, our diet and lifestyle set us up for being hyper responders. You know,
and cannabis is a check. It just helps it. It's a perfect antidote in a stressful day and age.
Why
it's such a big player.
Yeah.
And the fats, to your point, the fats that we're eating, right? Yeah. Where, you know, we have all these bad toxic omega-6 is good, but it's the toxic rancid omega-6 that we're getting in the diet and too much of all of this that is also affecting this cannabinoid system.
Absolutely.
Another reason, endocannabinoid system, another reason why cannabis can really help people.
Absolutely. Here is one of the coolest things that I learned in preparing for last week's talk. So you know the importance of DHA, from fish oil. DHA is absolutely one of the best.
I would say from fish more than fish oil because so much of it's rancid. Anyway, another subject.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point there. So when you take in a good quality DHA, one of the fates of DHA in the human brain is that DHA is converted into an endocannabinoid that has the name synaptamide. Yeah, what does that make you think about the neurological function of that endocannabinoid?
Synapses helps your brain fire better.
Yes, absolutely. So when you consume a healthy form of DHA, your brain converts some of that DHA into synaptamide. And synaptamide, it's called synaptamide because it is a major stimulator of synaptogenesis. So if you want to produce new neurological pathways, eat a good, healthy source of DHA to feed your endocannabinoid system.
Yeah. I mean, and you don't even need a lot to benefit, but the problem is again, all the rancid fats that we're getting out there makes it even more important. Fascinating, you know, conversation. I guess you'd make the argument that everybody could benefit from some CBD. Would you make that argument?
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, the thing with CBD is I don't like when people call it non-psychoactive because that's not true. CBD is psychoactive, and it's an anxiolytic. The thing with CBD is CBD supports a normal endocannabinoid system, whereas THC is kind of like the heavy hammer. When things are really bad, there is a time and place for THC. Mm-hmm. But I think on a day-to-day basis, I don't think that there's anybody in our modern world that would not benefit from CBD, especially when they combine it with some good, healthy, essential fatty acids.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, you see these kids smoking marijuana day in, day out. There's no doubt their brain's shrinking. There's no doubt it's having a negative effect. But you're right. I mean, someone in a very stressful situation, someone with cancer, the THC, I think, can bring a benefit. But when we look at the ancient hemp plant, it was very little THC. It was definitely more focused on the cannabinoid, the CBD.
Correct. Well, and you know, there's we always talk about the cannabis plant just in reference to CBD and THC. Well, those are just the two most predominant.
Yeah.
You know, there's a whole family of non-psychoactive cannabinoids that we're going to see coming out of the cannabis industry that are going to bring a lot of healing potential without the psychoactive properties as well.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Great combination. One last question. Right now, it's in vogue right now. Everybody's testing their SNPs and they're being put on a lot of supplements for their SNPs and they're labeling themselves. I'm homozygous MTHFR and they have all the labels. What's your thoughts on that? Which is very different than the epigenetics that we've been describing, right? SNPs. So what's your thoughts on that?
So I think there's a time and place for that. So if you as a health seeking individual want to get some clues on what might be the most high priority supplements for you to include in your diet, run your DNA.
Yep. It gives you clues. I agree.
You know, and I'm not going to say that everybody that has MTHFR is expressing and needs, but if you have MTHFR and your homocysteine is 20, you are the person that should be taking methylfolate and riboflavin and magnesium and all of the other. And see, this is the thing is MTHFR is one enzyme out of a family of enzymes that are involved in a pathway that utilizes B12 and 5-methylfolate, and they do a lot of very important functions. But if your MTHFR is not expressing and you have a normal homocysteine level and you're taking handfuls and handfuls of 5-methylfolate, you might just be wasting money on 5-methylfolate.
Well, you know, I think the system's very complicated. I mean, when you look at methylation alone, I think there's 21 steps in this methylation pathway, right? It's like very complicated. And I think we've learned more over the years that, you know, just because you have a SNP, epigenetically, the body finds ways around things. And we, as a practitioner, we don't know where you are in this process of DNA intelligence going, okay, we struggle here on this SNP, but however, we found a way around it. So you don't express it, right? You know, so I think that's the mistake that we're seeing right now is people are getting these tests and then they're just, I'm that. And then they think that they're that. And then they're taking supplements based on they're that. And it's, you might not be that. And that's what you're saying.
So, that's and that's why I always recommend a series of blood work. Because if you don't see signs of B12 deficiency in somebody with MTHFR, they probably don't, or they're probably not going to benefit from a, you know, strict regime of supplementation.
Yeah, they're not expressing that gene. So, well, the clues, it gives you clues. I couldn't have said it better, Steve. Listen, thank you so much for clarifying so many things. Genetics, epigenetics, the diet's role, the mitochondria is being, I guess it's a cornerstone today, right? I mean,
it is.
Yeah.
Absolutely, and without a doubt.
The good news is you gave us some great advice on how to change those genes in the mitochondria. Become a fat burner. Become metabolically flexible. It's possible. You can change it back.
It is. It is possible. You can affect the expression of your genes with everything that you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Stress reduction, toxin reduction, diet changes, getting rid of the sugar, you know, absolutely. And forcing adaptation, right? Yeah. It's like exercise.
So, and express more love.
There you go. Because thoughts also can change the genes for better or for worse. And the last piece of advice, cannabinoids.
CBD. Absolutely.
I think in today's day and age, you made an argument for fats. You made an argument for the stress that we're under. It affects the endocannabinoid system. It's under stress. There's a biohack. Got that
Absolutely.
Too. All right, Steve. Thanks for your brilliance, man. You're more than an egghead. You're a lot of fun, too.
Thank you, Dr. Palm. It was a pleasure. Absolutely.
And we love your wife, and join us at the seminar. Are you going to come with her?
No, I will be on dog sitting duty here in Mexico. It's our last week in Mexico, and I'm going to be getting our truck packed up while Nasha's in Nashville.
So yeah, we had that conversation because I'm like, you know, I love the summers and the falls and the springs here in Park City, Utah. I'm just tired of the winter. You know, I think I'm going to do what you guys did. I'm going to pack. We have dogs, so we have to go somewhere to drive. You drove through what part of Mexico?
We're just north of Puerto Vallarta, a little town of Bucerías. And from Durango, you know, we're just down the road from you in Durango in the summertime. And, you know, we pack up our dog, our two dogs and our cat and a truck full of surfboards and windsurfers now. And we take about 4 days driving down here. And we don't bring snow shovels.
Yeah, exactly. I'll be leaving those behind. That's my future. I'm driving my dogs.
Good. I can't wait to get some healthy sunshine with you down here to strengthen your mitochondria.
I'll be in Cancun again in April. So
cool. Well, I hope you enjoy it.
Not far off. Okay. Hey, we're going to have you on again because I think you have some other topics I want to pick your brain about. Thanks, Steve.
I'd love that. Thank you.
Well, that's it for this week. We hope you enjoyed today's episode. This episode was brought to you by Cyto Detox. Please check it out at buycytonow.com for more information. We'll be back next week and every Friday at 10 a.m. Eastern. We truly appreciate your support. You can always find us at podcast.drpompa.com. And please remember to spread the love by liking, subscribing, giving an iTunes review, and sharing the show with anyone you think may benefit from the information heard here. And as always, thanks for listening.